This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. And this is President Trump on Tuesday giving his State of the Union address.
Congress has 10 days left to pass a bill that will fund our government, protect our homeland, and secure our very dangerous southern border.
Trump and his wall. The wall, the wall, the wall. And as usual, with an assortment of misleading and blatantly false assertions. But when former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams offered the Democratic response, she didn't devote much time to rebutting the barbarians at the gate nonsense. Instead, she sort of changed the subject.
We can do so much more. Take action on climate change.
Climate change? Who said anything about climate change? Certainly not Trump. But it was a telling moment because under the new Democratic House majority, a lot of issues are going to be addressed through the prism of climate change, immigration being near the top of the list. That's because severe weather, rising temperatures, and rising sea levels will trigger waves of human migration, as the president likes to say, unlike anything we've seen before. In its most recent forecast in October, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimated we have only 12 years to moderate warming trends if we're to be saved the worst effects of drought, floods, and famine. But as Abrams' message foreshadowed, the focus is being turned away from impending doom to the utopian possibilities of government being unleashed to avert existential crisis. In fact, on Thursday, a group of Democrats presented a non-binding resolution to start to address the climate crisis.
Democrats are rolling out an ambitious plan to eliminate the U.S.'s carbon emissions and revamp the American economy. It's called the Green New Deal, and it's being spearheaded by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey.
Our first step is to define the problem and define the scope of the solution. And so we're here to say that small, incremental policy solutions are not enough.
Kate Aronoff has written about climate and the Green New Deal for The Intercept. She says that in order to rapidly strip fossil fuels and carbon emissions from the global economy in the next 12 years, we have to act fast and think big.
The Green New Deal tries to take in all of that and say, you know, we have this massive problem as we did in the aftermath of the Great Depression. And we don't really know what it looks like to fix it. We didn't really know what it looked like in the late 1920s and early 1930s to build a welfare state in the United States. But we did it because we invested resources in it and said, we have the money available, we can make this possible, and we're pretty screwed if we don't.
In your Intercept piece, you describe a sort of socialist and social justice utopia, wherein the battle to restore climate equilibrium will also address many other structural problems and inequities and even right historical wrongs. Can you give me some examples of the subsidiary benefits that flow, in your view, from the Green New Deal?
Sure. If you think of something like transforming our grid system, most of those jobs are unionized and very well paid. And that creates a lot of very well paid work to make our economy low carbon and to strip fossil fuels out of it. Something else the Green New Deal could do is to provide public transportation to folks who, you know, don't have access to it. If we had, say, high-speed rail connecting every major city in the country, that's something which not only improves our quality of life, but also creates many, many jobs. So you could also imagine something like a federal job guarantee being part of the Green New Deal And that would create basically a wage floor in the country. So you would offer a job to anyone who needs one and have the government be the employer of last resort and provide an alternative to these other sort of carbon-intensive jobs that are so common throughout the economy. And so the benefits really sort of, you know, flow out from one another. At the heart of it is a real recognition that this transition can be something that improves people's quality of life.
Let's talk about the history of this nascent movement. It's gone from virtually no share of the public conversation, at least as measured by Google searches and Twitter mentions, to most definitely a thing. Where did it come from? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's in the thick of it, but she is not the inventor of it.
Certainly not. So, funnily enough, the person who claims to have invented the term Green New Deal is Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, who in 2007 wrote a column basically calling for a rebrand of environmentalism. So to take it out of the realm of sort of hippies and tree huggers and make it this sort of macho capitalist project.
We have not only these kind of grand bargains between the environmental community and industry broadly, but that we understand that through them, we can actually propel innovation and entrepreneurship in this country.
That is not where its legacy has stayed since that time. There's a group of thinkers in the UK known as the Green New Deal Group who were the first to really do some substantial thinking about this and who Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's team have actually drawn a lot of inspiration from. And, you know, it's been in the Green Party's platform since about 2012. Jill Stein made it a prominent part of her campaign.
An emergency Green New Deal to create 25 million jobs, end unemployment, and jumpstart the green economy.
And Van Jones, a former quote-unquote job czar in the Obama administration, talked about a Green New Deal as a way to sort of shape the stimulus and the response to the Great Recession. But its real reemergence was when about 200 young people with the Sunrise Movement, this youth climate organization, occupied Nancy Pelosi's office, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined them there.
We are here to demand that Nancy Pelosi and Democratic establishment leadership step up and actually create a plan to stop this crisis that is imperiling all of our generation's lives, that we actually...
All right, that's the history. Speaking of history, and as you alluded to earlier, there's plenty. It was called the New Deal, and that was the original means by which an activist government mobilized against the ongoing catastrophe of the Great Depression with public funds, public works, vast infrastructure expansion, and so on. Not because even in 1930 the public loved a socialist-style command economy, but because the alternative was economic collapse.
The members of the Congress realized that the methods of normal times had to be replaced in the emergency by measures that were suited to the serious and pressing requirements of the moment.
So I think the circumstances are parallel, even if you look at the lead up to the New Deal. So Herbert Hoover, who dealt with the very early days of the Great Depression, was consistently unable to figure out what this crisis was. He didn't know the scale of it, what had caused it, and was so committed to the idea of private businesses being able to meet the needs of the people that he really was just so opposed to the idea of federal intervention in the economy. And so one of the first programs that he unveils is this ad campaign to encourage people to invest in charities. But that doesn't work. And there just really wasn't an avenue for folks who were struggling to get their basic needs met. And so there was this sort of mass social uprising from people who were being thrown out of work, who couldn't feed their families, saying, please have the government intervene in our lives to make them better. And so that was sort of the call that FDR brought into the office and how he got into the office. And, you know, even as he was governor of New York, implemented several programs that would find their way into the New Deal later on.
Now, earlier I mentioned flipping the narrative. On the other hand, I kind of feel like Jor-El on Krypton.
And we're like, the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. And your biggest issue...
The ticking clock is still a part of the pitch.
Yeah, and I think that is certainly a part of referencing back to the New Deal. And the other thing that people bring up often is the mobilization around World War II, which looked at a similar existential threat and devoted a massive amount of federal resources to confronting it. And, you know, I think that is absolutely the mindset we need to be in. There are climate scientists who are increasingly calling for a quote-unquote wartime footing to deal with climate change. I think the New Deal and the Great Depression and something like the moon landing, if we were to combine all of those things together, then we might start to get a sense for the scale of work that this transition will require and the sort of vast nature of it.
There is significant buy-in already from some key Democrats.
Will you fully endorse the Green New Deal tonight?
I support a Green New Deal.
Well, we have to have a Green New Deal for America. We need
a Green New Deal is creating many millions of decent-paying jobs, transforming our...
But as a society, we've been fighting over health insurance since the 1990s. So, yeah, Krypton and all that, but Republicans, does the future of Green New Deal not hinge on people who simply don't want any part of it?
Yeah, it's a good question. But I think what the Green New Deal framing does smartly, and the people pushing for it are smartly getting around, is this tendency within environmental groups to sort of go begging to Republicans to say, please support our climate policy. We'll make it as weak as possible if you just get on board. And we've seen this, you know, time and time again, most notably in 2009 with Waxman-Markey, with this cap and trade bill.
Ratifies the fact that emissions trading is a policy tool that will be employed.
Which started off as somewhat decent legislation for the time. And through the course of debating, it just got watered down so much to the point where if it had been passed, that bill would have kneecapped the environmental protection agencies in ways that Andrew Wheeler and Scott Pruitt could really only dream of. And so that has been a trap that I think a lot of environmentalists and Democrats have fallen into, is saying that, you know, we will only get climate policy if we convince enough Republicans to get on board. But as we've seen, this is such a deeply partisan issue that, you know, I don't think Republicans really come to the table in good faith to debate climate policy, particularly not given the millions of dollars that they get from the fossil fuel industry every year in campaign contributions.
I want to end by bringing this back to something I was kind of hinting at in the introduction, and that is President Trump's obsession with migration at the southern border. Now, the fact checkers have documented chapter and verse why almost everything he says about the threat is untrue. But the irony of this conversation is that if the climate is left unchecked, it'll all come true.
Some of the migration that we're already seeing from Latin America is due to folks not being able to harvest their crops because their fields are going fallow because of the effects of climate change. That's not all of it, of course, but climate is sort of a factor in why people are heading north and seeking jobs and, you know, in some cases, protection. So, you know, we will see more migration. That is just sort of a reality of the world that we're living in, no matter how quickly we mitigate climate change. But I think this gets back to something that is really powerful, I think, about the Green New Deal framing, which is that we have to learn how the state can do new things, how the state can learn new tricks to deal with a very different world. Climate change will affect every single policy field in the next century. And so, you know, immigration is a climate issue, whether Trump talks about it like that or not. And it deserves folks who are thinking about climate change to have a real response to that, which takes seriously the need to have a really humane approach to inviting folks into the country, I think.
Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kate Aronoff is a contributing writer for The Intercept. Coming up, the man who helped make Facebook what it is desperately trying to make amends. This is On the Media.
This is Brooke. When you finish listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? My colleague David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie.
This is the only idea I've ever had for a film.
Really?
I never get asked to do a film.
Really?
Never.
You know, you really should listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So please, do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Back in the halcyon days of 2006, when the world was innocent and Facebook had a mere 12 million users, Roger McNamee got a call. At the time, he was just a member of a jam band, the one we're listening to, actually, and also a rich and influential Silicon Valley investor whose business partner was Bono. The phone call was from a Facebook executive asking if McNamee would meet with 22-year-old Mark Zuckerberg.
When I first met Mark, I was very excited because I thought he had exactly the idea at exactly the right time. It was not at all obvious the day I met him that anything could possibly go wrong in this idea.
Yeah, well, live and learn. But something was obvious to McNamee, and he volunteered it before the young entrepreneur even opened his mouth.
I said, if it hasn't already happened, either Yahoo or Microsoft is going to offer $1 billion to buy Facebook. And everybody you know is going to say, Mark, take the money. You can change the world with that kind of money. Your venture capitalist will tell you he'll back your next startup and you'll be just as successful the next time. And I said, Mark, look, I can't tell you what to do. But if you really believe in your vision, you're going to have to explain to these people that you're not going to sell. What followed was the most unbelievable thing that's ever occurred to me in a business meeting.
Zuckerberg sat there, ruminating, total silence, for 5 minutes.
Imagine a human being pantomiming thinker poses.
5 minutes?
Without saying a word. At about the three-minute mark, my fingernails are embedded in the couch cushions, and I'm having a really hard time not screaming.
Zuckerberg might have been a little freaked out, too, because unbeknownst to McNamee, he had indeed gotten such an offer from Yahoo of $1 billion. The near-future tycoon asked,
how did you know? I said, Mark, I've been doing this quarter of a century. This is what happens when a company is as promising as Facebook.
This may have been a rare moment in the history of Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg was not only reflective about the downstream ramifications of a business decision, but he heeded the wisdom of an outsider. And then, not long thereafter, he did the same thing by taking McNamee's suggestion to hire former senior Treasury Department official and Google exec Sheryl Sandberg as COO. A decade later, Facebook is valued at a half trillion dollars, and Zuckerberg is among the richest and most influential men on earth. Good talk, son. As an investor and as a citizen, McNamee has continued to pay much closer attention to Facebook than Zuckerberg would prefer. For the past 2.5 years, he's been warning first Facebook management, then everybody else, that the world's dominant social media platform has become a menace.
A new report has found that Facebook failed to prevent its platform being used to incite violence in Myanmar.
Cambridge Analytica mined users' information without their consent.
Facebook hired a PR firm to dig up dirt on its competitors,
helping to spread misinformation and fake news stories that benefit.
In a new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, McNamee presents a bill of indictment for the company's many victims, our economy, our media, our public health, our actual brains, and our democracy. The core of the problem, he says, began with the 2006 introduction of the Facebook news feed.
The biggest single problem with it was that it doesn't have a signal to stop. When you're watching television, eventually the credits roll, and that's a signal to go on and do something else. News feed is infinite. There is no signal. If you take that in combination with tagging, where you would tag the people in the photograph. And then Facebook would send a message saying, hey, so-and-so tagged you in this photograph. And that creates a psychological need, validation, but also a need to reciprocate. And so it turned out that tagging was the first thing inside Facebook that created virality. It was the first step on the way to this horrible problem. But in the early days, it seemed really harmless. And they basically wore us down. In 2011, a genius from MoveOn named Eli Pariser introduced the idea of the filter bubble.
Mark Zuckerberg, a journalist, was asking him a question about the news feed. And the journalist was asking him, you know, why is this so important? And Zuckerberg said, a squirrel dying in your front yard may be more relevant to your interests right now than people dying in Africa.
And he noticed that his news feeds on Google and Facebook were no longer neutral, that they were essentially playing to what they perceived were his biases. And they weren't telling him they were doing that. They weren't telling anybody that. And so he was really worried that by altering the experience without us knowing it, there were going to be unintended consequences we weren't going to like. And I don't know that he knew then what that meant. I know I didn't. But what we discovered was that it was going to be enough to affect, you know, how democracy works all over the world.
One of the most indicting facts in your book gets to their strategy of building scale at all costs, going from 600 million users to 1 billion users to now 2.2 billion users worldwide. And part of that strategy hinged on deals with third-party apps.
In the early years of Facebook, the sole goal was to add users. But eventually, when they decided it was time to get revenue, somebody somewhere figured out that if they were going to get revenue, it wasn't enough to have people show up for a minute a day. They needed to keep them a lot longer so they could see ads. And Zynga, which created Farmville and Cityville and a bunch of other games, came to market with that precise insight and crafted a business model for games inside Facebook. They basically tricked Facebook's algorithms to give them access to Facebook friends lists. And the result of which was that you almost immediately saw an increase in the number of minutes per day people were using Facebook. And the economic benefit to Facebook was huge. What was really inappropriate about it was that the Federal Trade Commission came to the company off of the Zynga experience and a few things like it and said, we're going to force you to sign a consent decree. You can't do this with people's data. You have to get informed prior consent. They basically didn't hire anybody to enforce the decree. They didn't change their products in any way. They continued to let applications download all of the friends' data from the people who use them. And that's how Cambridge Analytica got the data it used. The reason I'm sympathetic towards them is that they didn't go out of their way to exploit every advantage they had in those early days. It took them a while to get there. Their resistance got worn down by degrees, and the pressure of going public, the pressure of the earnings forecasts that came way down during the public offering process, all of those things conspired to raise the pressure on Mark and Sheryl, and I think led to them making changes in policy that created all the problems.
But if the principals were at first unaware of the power they were wielding, as McNamee says, they should certainly have known better by 2016, when Alex Stamos, then Facebook's chief security officer, assembled a team to investigate how Russian operatives had pushed propaganda on Facebook.
I wasn't speaking publicly in 2016. I just went to them and said, guys, I see all these different things going on. In my book, I give you the draft op-ed that I shared with them on October 30th in 2016 that describes what my fears were, which turns out were correct. And then Stamos gave them real data in December, and they were totally resistant to that. And where I have the problem is that once the facts became undeniable, at some point, companies have to take responsibility for the consequences of their actions. And Facebook is amazingly profitable because they've never had to bear the cost of the consequences of their actions. And, you know, that used to be true of the chemical industry. And then we decided in the 70s that, no, I'm sorry, we're going to have these things called Superfund sites, and you guys are responsible for cleaning them up. That day of reckoning is coming here, and it can't come soon enough from my perspective.
All right. Your book looks at Facebook and at Google, the other half of the duopoly, and at the rest of social media, much of which is owned by Facebook. And you offer a template for dealing with the issues that these platforms have wrought. It would seem to be a clear antitrust case against the duopoly because they're so horizontally and vertically integrated. But we run into this problem that the users get the service for free, which presents a regulation problem, no?
It does. Since 1981, we've operated with this notion that for antitrust law, the only possible consumer harm is an increase in price. And because these are notionally free products, they seem to get a pass. That's a narrow reading. What's really going on is that it's a barter where the companies trade services for personal data. And there's actually an increasing body of economic research that points out that in those transactions, the data is the currency. So it is possible to measure changes in price and changes in value received. And so there's a lot of work going on. And a Nobel Prize was awarded last year to a couple of professors for solving this problem relative to carbon credits, another situation with that currency involved.
Throughout the book, you quote Mark Zuckerberg's founding bromide.
This idea, we cared about so much that all people want to connect. So we just kept pushing forward on it.
Do you believe he's just in denial about the Frankenstein's monster he's created? Or is he knowingly risking the health of societies out of greed and ambition?
I don't know. My guess is that how he looks at the problem has changed. But, you know, obviously he's not talking to me, so I don't know exactly how he's thinking about it. And Cheryl's not talking to me either, so I don't know how she's thinking about it either. But I do know that they're not playing this game at an intellectual level. I mean, the thing that really broke my heart last year was when the news came out, Facebook retaining a political opposition research firm called Definers to spread disinformation about two critics, one of whom was Apple Computer, the other of whom was George Soros. And the technique that Definers used on Soros was to spread an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that had originated in Eastern Europe. I've tried my best to keep a positive view of two people I really trusted and that I worked with for a number of years and that I really liked. And it gets harder by the day to do that.
One last thing. We discussed how you were the one who turned Mark Zuckerberg onto Sheryl Sandberg. We talked about how in 2006, when Yahoo was trying to bid on Facebook, you advised young Mark Zuckerberg not to accept the deal. Is this all your fault?
Well, I feel an enormous sense of responsibility because every morning I wake up and think to myself, you know, I played a small role. This thing had 1,000 fathers, and my role wasn't that big. But there were these two things that happened that really did make a difference. And if they hadn't happened, you'd have had a different outcome. But there are a lot of things that also happened that could have also put us back on a good track, and those didn't happen either. And what I hope is that everybody who's been involved will pull together and just let's help these companies get to the right place to make that change, to give them permission to reverse course and to go back to the idealism that infected Silicon Valley for so many years.
You still have a Facebook account?
Oh, not only that, I'm still a shareholder. But my usage has changed a lot. I don't do any politics anymore. I don't get any news from it. I don't block anybody. I don't get into arguments. I just let all that stuff slide off me. And I advise others to do the same. You know, people who are not on Facebook, people who are not on Google, are still touched by all of this stuff. We all have a stake in it. And these companies right now are transforming the economy to their benefit without doing what Joseph Schumpeter would have described as the appropriate form of creative destruction, which is one where the new thing fills all the holes left by the old and makes the world a better place. Because for these guys, what they're doing now is they're doing the destruction part, seizing the value, and then not replacing it. We now know that's not healthy, and we should probably try to stop it everywhere in the economy.
Roger, thank you very much.
This has been a huge pleasure for me and a thrill, so thank you so very much.
Roger McNamee, former venture capitalist, is now an activist and author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Facebook, as we have heard, is under the absolute control of Mark Zuckerberg, which is cool for him because he gets to be a multi-billionaire sultan. But when things go wrong, and they always go wrong, he also gets all the blame.
You've created these platforms, and now they are being misused. And you have to be the ones to do something about it, or we will.
That was Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein. Zuckerberg has been hearing such indignation off and on for 15 years. And for 15 years, he's been responding as follows. A mealy-mouthed mea culpa.
I don't think we are transparent enough around the prevalence of different issues on the platform.
Followed by promises seldom fulfilled to do better.
From now on, Facebook will do more to keep you safe and protect your privacy, so we can all get back to what made Facebook good in the first place.
These tactics have worn thin, but now a new wrinkle, the creation by Facebook of an independent international board of reviewers charged with adjudicating decisions about permissible content, a so-called Supreme Court of Facebook. No authority on ad targeting or data privacy or, you know, human brain manipulation, but still an independent judiciary. How proactive is that? Facebook is so proud, in fact, that contrary to its standard practice of declining OTM interviews, it offered up a real live employee to discuss it. Andy O'Connell is a manager of content distribution and algorithm policy at Facebook. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so it's been called the Facebook Supreme Court. Is it that?
We recognize that we bear the ultimate responsibility for what we keep up or what we take down. And we obviously are still going to continue making those important decisions every day all around the world. But the intent of this board is to ensure that we're striking the right balance between giving people voice, keeping people safe. And we want this board to hold us accountable and provide that independent oversight as we do that important work.
Who will be on this board?
We don't know who these specific people are. A big part of this is putting these questions to the public, to stakeholders around the world, and making these decisions together with the people who have an interest in how Facebook operates.
You don't know exactly who the players will be, the individuals, but I imagine you do know precisely what they would be the judge of. What do you expect to come before them?
The core issue that we're talking about is whether a particular piece of content should be allowed on Facebook under the Facebook values and community standards.
Now, there are millions of posts per day on Facebook worldwide. How will particularly problematic ones find their way to the panel?
We can imagine cases bubbling up through our existing appeal system. Already today on Facebook, you can appeal if we take down your posts, for example, because our reviewers determine that it violates our hate speech or bullying policies. And you can go back to us and say, no, you got that wrong. Take another look, and we will. So you can imagine us trying to build a mechanism on top of that that connects more directly to this external oversight board. You can also imagine a very different system where perhaps this board sets up their own infrastructure to which people can create petitions and try to get people in the community or around the world to endorse the board hearing a case on a particular matter. There's a lot of design decisions that need to be made, but those are among the sort of two big paths we can imagine going down.
And whatever decisions the board makes on a particular piece of content, will that be deemed to be precedent, as with the U.S. Supreme Court governing the subsequent treatment of similar cases?
We acknowledge that these decisions need to be binding and transparent. We think reason giving is going to be a really important part of helping people to understand why decisions are made, but also helping Facebook as a company figure out how to improve our larger enforcement system.
If I'm one of those moderators and something comes up, can I rule that, you know, under the terms of the Oversight Council's ruling on user Margaret Ann versus Alex Jones, we are going to remove this content from the platform?
I think exactly how we would implement that is an open question, but I do think it is important that there is a feedback mechanism between the decisions of this board and how the company operates.
I have to ask you this. You are no doubt familiar with the old saw that a lie travels around the world three times while the truth is still putting on its pants. On Facebook, we're speaking of milliseconds. Whether insane Pizzagate conspiracies or Russian propaganda, all the scandalous activity that has brought Facebook under the glare of suspicion and scorn, your content moderation infrastructure, those 30,000 people, you know, obviously have been useless. Mobs form quickly and violently. How in the world would this be mitigated by the empaneling of an even more deliberate Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think it's an important question. Those decisions, as you've suggested, need to be made quickly with lots of local context, local language expertise all around the world 24 hours per day. This board would supplement that by providing an additional way for the most controversial, the most consequential, the highest public interest decisions to have a more thorough public treatment in a way that can provide feedback to improve those systems going forward.
Facebook lives every day with the sort of Damocles called regulation perpetually hanging over its head. One way to stave off government regulation is self-regulation. But whether or not this initiative should keep Congress and the FTC and the Justice Department at bay, another benefit to the company, say the next time Mark appears on Capitol Hill after things have gone horribly wrong, is that he will have a third party to blame. There is a line of thinking from Max Reed, writing in New York Magazine, that the Supreme Court would function as a supreme scapegoat. Is that just too cynical?
I think that no matter how we construct this board, Facebook is ultimately going to be responsible for what we keep up or what we take down. And again, we're still going to need to make these decisions, you know, millions of times per day across 30,000 people around the world. And we accept and embrace that responsibility and want to keep doing a better job with that responsibility.
You know, Andy, whenever we discuss Facebook on the program, we ask to speak with someone from the company to get comment or respond to whatever else is said. And the answer is always no. It took the U.S. Congress a year to get Mark Zuckerberg to testify. Yet, for this request, the company made you available immediately. And therefore, I am obliged to ask, is this oversight board exercise designed to deal with the actual threats that face us? Or is it a PR gimmick to deflect the ever-mounting suspicion and scorn? Or, you know, maybe both.
The purpose of this board is to provide another layer of oversight and accountability and transparency to the content moderation decisions that we make every day. And that independence, accountability, and transparency emphasis is really what's driving this.
And the publicity is just a bonus?
I think that, again, the initiative that we're working on here is trying to accomplish those goals that I've said.
Well, Andy, thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Andy O'Connell is a manager of content distribution and algorithm policy at Facebook. Coming up, two streetwise Irishmen with a lot of moxie and a lot of heart, who for decades gave voice to the powerless in New York City and beyond. This is On the Media.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Back in the day, the stereotype for a reporter was ink-stained wretch. No fancy pedigree, no pretensions, just a nosy ruffian scuffing shoe leather in pursuit of a good yarn. Then came the professionalization of the industry, all J-school and good manners, and then came the industry's financial collapse, and a whole breed of journalism has all but vanished. There are no pixel-stained wretches. It's almost hard to imagine that only a few years ago, the likes of Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin were the beating hearts of New York City reporting.
These guys were like superstars.
They were everywhere.
People saw them as the voice of true New Yorkers.
That's from the trailer of the HBO documentary Deadline Artists Breslin and Hamill, tabloid columnists who for decades were the scribes of and for working-class New York. Breslin died in 2017. Hamill is still writing, but the newspaper world they populated is all but vanished. Journalist and author Jonathan Alter co-directed and co-produced the documentary with Steve McCarthy and John Block. John Alter, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be here.
Breslin and Hamill were giants, but they were giants mainly of the last century and mainly of New York City. For the benefit of younger generations and those of our listeners beyond the five boroughs, who were these guys?
Every community in the United States had a local newspaper columnist who was basically a Jimmy Breslin wannabe. That's how big Breslin was. Pete Hamill was not as famous as Jimmy Breslin, but he was a sort of dashing figure. He was dating the most famous woman in the world, Jacqueline Onassis, and a top movie star, Shirley MacLaine, at the same time. Neither of these guys finished college. They both came from the streets, and they reported on the streets.
What's remarkable about these two, and I guess you know this better than anybody, is that they were larger than life in almost exactly the same way. They were pugnacious creatures of the street, pounding out columns for the tabloids. In fact, here's one of the star journalists you interviewed for the film.
I mean, in the early gritty days of journalism, you didn't have an Ivy League degree, and you never made a particularly good salary. You were much more naturally of the street than you were when the whole thing became a profession.
That voice sounds familiar. Here's how Pete Hamill expressed a similar thought.
Once there was another city here, and now it is gone. There are almost no traces of it anymore, but millions of us know it existed because we lived in it, the lost city of New York.
Your film traces their careers sometimes in parallel and sometimes intersecting as they cover some of the big stories of the last 50 years, the Kennedy assassination, Son of Sam, 9/11. Someone in the film points out that they were like Zelig or Forrest Gump. Wherever history happened, there they were. They were both in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in 1968 with Bobby Kennedy when he was shot.
And there was Sirhan with his arm out like this, and a long group of us leaped on him.
What's his name? Sirhan. I'm on his feet. I sat on him.
Pete Hamill grabbed Sirhan Sirhan, the assassin, and then Jimmy Breslin sat on Sirhan Sirhan's feet until the cops got there, and then Jimmy rode with Bobby Kennedy to the hospital. And Pete Hamill went into a tailspin after Bobby Kennedy's assassination.
We knew that America had struck again in this slimy little indoor rally in the back of a gaudy ballroom. I saw Kennedy lurch against the ice machine and then sag, and I knew that he was dead.
He had, as he confesses in the film, gotten too close to Kennedy as a reporter, and it was a mistake he never made again. He had actually written him a letter urging him to run for president, and then Kennedy sent him a letter back saying, I'm taking your advice, I'm running, and I need your help. And Pete later reflected that that's not what you should do when you're a journalist, and he never did it again.
So that was in L.A., but they plied their trade mainly in New York, covering the arrest, for example, of the so-called Central Park Five, boys from the projects who were rounded up after the rape and beating of a jogger in the 80s.
Hate was just another luxury. And Trump stood naked, revealed as the spokesman for that tiny minority of Americans who lead well-defended lives. Forget poverty and its causes. Forget the degradation and squalor of millions. Fry them into passivity.
That was Pete Hamill writing. After more than a decade in prison, the guys were freed when another man confessed to the crime and the DNA matched. Breslin took up the cause for someone else who came unjustly in the glare of publicity and rush to judgment, a rookie NYPD cop named Sibella Borges. Tell me that story.
A woman cop named Sibella Borges is fired from the New York Police Department because before she was a cop, she had posed nude for a magazine called Beaver, which, as Jimmy later wrote, is a magazine men read with one hand. So she was fired, and she was just pilloried in the press. And Jimmy took up her cause and said, you know, why should she be fired for something that she did before she was on the force? And why isn't the police union representing her? That's what they're supposed to do.
The police department should have been proud of the pictures, as they proved that at least one member of the force is in marvelous physical condition.
The police union then takes out full-page ads attacking Jimmy Breslin. But eventually, his columns are so persuasive that a court reinstates her, and they saw their job as sticking up for the ordinary guy and woman who is often neglected by the news media. And so even though they were these larger-than-life characters, and they certainly knew every celebrity in the world, and they covered big stories with major historical figures, their bread and butter was more writing about people who just needed a hand.
We talked about them being a breed apart. What that meant literally was that they typically did not follow the herd of other journalists. Their prose was spectacular, but the angles they came up with were equally profound. When JFK was shot, Breslin followed the story to Dallas, like hundreds of other reporters, but he came up with an angle that makes your heart skip a beat. He covered the assassination through the eyes of the ER doctor. And then a few days later, he covers the Arlington Cemetery burial of the dead president from the perspective of the gravedigger.
Polly, could you please be here by 11 o'clock this morning? Kowalczyk asked. I guess you know what it's for. Polly did. He hung up the phone, finished breakfast, and left his apartment so he could spend Sunday digging a grave for John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
This became one of the most famous newspaper columns ever written by an American. It's taught in many journalism schools. And the reason is because it contains the most important lesson for a reporter on a story. Get away from the pack, find a fresh angle, use your wits to bring something new and different to the reader. And if you do that, you can distinguish yourself in the business.
New York tabloid journalism was sort of the canary in the coal mine for the collapse of the daily newspaper economy in this country. And one of the great moments of foreshadowing was when a developer, I think it was, named Abe Hirschfeld, bought the New York Post, and the first thing he did was fire his editor-in-chief, Pete Hamill.
This was in the 1990s when newspapers were kind of hemorrhaging cash and were changing hands a lot. But this was a sort of a symbol of taking somebody who was absolutely beloved in New York journalism, Pete Hamill, and throwing him out on his ear and then lying about it and claiming that he didn't.
This is what happened when Hirschfeld told workers he didn't fire Hamill.
Hirschfeld shot back today by firing 71 employees and threatening to fold the paper if it doesn't publish tomorrow.
And there was a period where the inmates took over the asylum. They put out the newspaper from a coffee shop on the ground floor because Pete was barred from the building. And, you know, they ran headlines like, "Who is this nut?" referring to their owner. So it was just a raucous and fun, if ultimately doomed, rebellion in New York journalism.
As you survey the landscape of what's left of Metro columning, is there anybody who is the heir to the Breslin-Hamel legacy?
I don't think there's anybody who is doing exactly what they did, but I think Dan Barry and Jim Dwyer are terrific. You know, there's great work now, but we're not going to see another print journalist who hosts Saturday Night Live. It's just not going to happen.
John, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Jonathan Alter with Steve McCarthy and John Block was director, producer of the new HBO documentary, Breslin and Hamel, Deadline Artists. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Oscar Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.